The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the sixth reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. I'm Debbie Robertson. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In chapters 16 through 20, Jane took one step closer to being able to dream that one day she could live in complete independence with Mario. She learned to cook. Her patience would be tested again and again, though, as Mario started his advanced academic career, first at Ball State Teachers College, then Notre Dame Law School. After that, he still had to take the bar exam, which he passed with high praise, and then started his law practice to prove to the world that he could make a living that would be sufficient to support a wife and family, a feat that took over 6 years to accomplish. What a determined man he was. And now we continue with The Sound of Her Voice. Chapter 21, Leading the Way. As a young man beginning his law practice, Mario didn't want a guide dog. He used a white cane mostly to warn others that he was blind. He was able to get wherever he needed to go in Muncie without fear of tripping or getting lost. Mario concentrated on where he was at every moment, listening to the street sounds and stopping at street corners. He did not walk with his arms outstretched. He was proud of his ability to navigate, but on rare occasions that he stumbled or tripped, he was embarrassed and angry at himself for his lapse of concentration. Soon after Mario joined his brother in the office, Charles began encouraging him to get a guide dog. Charles thought that Mario's independence would increase with the dog, enabling him to navigate around town and travel on business trips more easily. After a few months of not-so-gentle nudging, Mario applied for a dog at the Seeing Eye, the first guide dog school in the country. Jane never felt the need for her own guide dog, but supported Mario's decision to get one. She was not trained to walk independently at the school for the blind. Females who were not expected to work or leave home would always need an escort. Independence training was only offered to boys. If Jane wanted to leave the house, she depended upon walking with a sighted person. Being dependent upon someone else didn't bother her. She usually found a family member to accompany her on errands or shopping. Mario took the train to Morristown, New Jersey in early June 1941. Before the school would allow him to meet his dog, the trainers observed him for a couple of days. He had to prove that he was well-oriented and that he could walk around without assistance. Mario passed with flying colors. Mario never forgot the day that he met Carla, a 2-year-old German shepherd. She was a bright, spirited dog, and Mario took an instant liking to her. They were observed to ensure that the dog's personality matched his, along with her size and stride. When the trainers were satisfied that Carla and Mario were a good match, they began training with simple tasks. Mario learned to harness and leash Carla and how to feel her movements through the harness. Mario trained with Carla for about 4 weeks, learning how to work with her and to trust her. The instructors took them through any situation that he might encounter at home, such as low-hanging branches on a sidewalk, crossing busy intersections and uneven sidewalks. The trainers emphasized that it was a cooperative partnership between the man and the dog, stressing the importance of consistent discipline. He learned to reward Carla with lavish praise and affection every time she did what she was supposed to do. He'd pat her on the head and say, "Good dog." He could feel her head looking up at him, and if they were stopped, she often licked his hand. When Mario gave the command forward, she took off at a swift pace. At first, it was a bit intimidating to walk so fast with her, but soon he relaxed as he became more trusting of his guide. Mario, who was about 6 feet tall, had a naturally long stride, and the two walked well together. It was important for Mario to concentrate while training. If his attention lapsed, he might not notice that he was at an intersection, or he would forget to praise Carla when she did something right. While out on the streets of Morristown, the trainer stayed with them and directed Mario which way to walk and which streets to cross. The trainer watched carefully for any potential problems or to correct his technique. Contrary to a popular myth, dogs can't see colors and don't watch the stoplight. The master is responsible for listening for the direction that the cars are going and to determine if they have stopped. The dogs are trained not to step off the curb unless it is safe. Near the end of the training, Mario and Carla took the train into New York City for the ultimate test of managing in a large city. Blaring car horns and sirens echoed off the tall buildings, making it difficult to know if a car was honking at him or another car. Mario worked very hard to maintain his concentration as they threaded their way past sidewalks crowded with people, push carts selling hot dogs, and mothers pushing baby carriages. Carla and Mario passed the test. He was so proud of her. He knew that if she could guide him through Manhattan, she'd be perfect to help him get around Muncie or wherever he'd want to go. The new duo took the train back to Muncie, where Mario was expecting his parents to meet him at the station. He was flabbergasted to find not only his parents, but also a newspaper reporter. Carla was the first seeing eye dog in Muncie, and she was big news. The first of many stories about Mario and Carla was published in the local paper. Shortly after the article appeared, the Peroni and Peroni law firm's telephone began ringing. Mario was pleasantly surprised to have several new clients in response to the publicity. Immediately, he became even more recognizable around town. Mario was known as the man with the dog, and people were eager to hear how a dog could lead a blind man to wherever he wanted to go. Over the years, he spoke with countless church groups, Boy Scouts, Kiwanis and Rotary clubs, and students in high school and at Ball State Teachers College, now Ball State University. He talked frankly about his blindness, how the dogs were trained at the seeing eye, and how they helped a blind person. Despite the number of talks and interviews Mario gave about his guide dogs, many people still believe that the dog knew where his master wanted to go and would take him there, stopping for red lights along the way. While it appeared to passers-by that the dog was in charge, Mario was the master, telling the dog which way to turn. The dog only takes the master around obstacles and stops at curbs. Mario used his excellent sense of direction and concentrated while walking. If he didn't focus or carelessly began to daydream, he would end up lost, the thought of which terrified him. It would be humiliating to be forced to ask for help. On the streets and in offices or stores, adults and children wanted to pet Carla. Mario had many opportunities to teach them not to pet or talk to her. He explained that Carla was a working dog, not a pet, and shouldn't be distracted. Gradually, though, it became easier, and the people who saw Mario regularly learned how to behave around the dog. The two quickly settled into a daytime routine. Each morning, he put the leather harness over her head and belted it securely under her belly. The harness was critical, and it allowed him to feel every movement she made. The movement would direct him around people, sidewalk obstacles, and guide him into the entry doors of buildings. Double-checking that the harness was secure, Mario then attached her leash to the metal chain around her neck. With both in place, they were ready to head to the office. Once Mario was seated at his desk, Carla curled up at his feet and waited for the next command. This was her time off, though Carla remained alert. If Mario needed to leave his desk, he simply attached her leash to the chair and said, "Stay." The dog laid on the floor, patiently waiting for him to return. She was not allowed to roam loose around the office. A few months later, Mario realized with surprise how dependent he'd become upon Carla. She had increased his already strong confidence. Now he could go anywhere and not worry about stepping into puddles or bumping into other pedestrians. An acquaintance told him that he made it look easy. He smiled and thanked the man, but gave credit to Carla for being a dependable guide. In 1946, the Muncie Evening Press ran a two-paragraph story headlined, "Blind Attorney, Dog in Flight to West Coast." The article said, "Today, he and his seeing eye dog took off on their longest aerial jaunt to date, a trip to Portland, Oregon, where the Muncie attorney is to appear in a legal action. Peroni left at daybreak for South Bend, where he was to catch a westbound airliner at 10 o'clock. Traveling by plane in 1946 was becoming more common, but a blind man and a dog taking the trip by plane warranted noting in the local paper. When traveling in unfamiliar cities, Mario often asked for directions, either from the hotel desk clerk or someone on the street, and increased his already intense focus. Despite the challenges of walking with a guide dog, Mario and his subsequent 7 loyal seeing eye dogs always found their way to his destination. Chapter 22. Good Enough. While Jane waited 7 long years for Mario to finish law school and establish his law practice, she had plenty of time to hear her folks' doubts about how they would manage as a married couple. Living with them on the farm provided her with opportunities to overhear conversations between her parents and other relatives. At that time, blind people were viewed as helpless, asexual beings who could not function independently. The very idea of 2 blind people marrying was unthinkable to most people. How could he earn a living? How could she cook and clean? There was no way for them to manage by themselves, much less care for and raise children. No doubt Mario's parents had the same concerns. In addition to the skeptics, Jane and Mario had a more personal and formidable problem to overcome. Jane had been brought up in the Church of the United Brethren, a small conservative church in the village of Lincolnville. There were few Roman Catholics in her rural area. Mario was one of the first she'd ever met. He was the son of devout Italian immigrants who went to daily Mass and strictly adhered to church teachings. Catholics were only to marry other Catholics. Both sets of parents worried about their child marrying outside of their faith. Mario was also strong in his faith and asked Jane if she would be willing to convert to Catholicism before their marriage. She agreed, although her parents made it clear that they disapproved of her decision. Her conversion was one more worry that Charles and Bessie had about the upcoming marriage. They were skeptical that the couple could be self-sufficient and didn't hesitate to relay their fears to Jane. Yet Jane and Mario were determined to establish the life they'd dreamed of for so long. Mario worked hard to build his law practice and finally convinced Jane that he could support her. At age 28, Jane could plan her wedding and look forward to living an independent life with Mario. 16 years after first hearing Jane's voice recite a poem in 4th grade, Mario and Jane were married on October 21st, 1941. After the 8 a.m. wedding mass held at Mario's parish church, the St. Lawrence Catholic Church, the happy couple celebrated with a breakfast reception at a downtown Muncie hotel. Jane's parents, sisters, and other relatives drove down that morning from their farms in Muncie for the ceremony. She'd been worried that Charles and Bessie might say something critical of her conversion and marriage into the Catholic Church, but was relieved that they were respectful and didn't complain that day. Later that afternoon, Jane, Mario, and Carla boarded a train for Chicago, where they spent 4 days visiting friends and attending concerts. They stayed in the luxurious Stevens Hotel in downtown, which was quite a treat for Jane, as she had rarely traveled. They had no difficulty getting around. Mario had been to Chicago on business several times and was familiar with the streets. One evening, they walked a few blocks to Orchestra Hall for a concert. If Mario wasn't familiar with how to get somewhere, they took a taxi cab. When he needed directions, he asked the hotel's desk clerk, and if along the way Mario still needed help in getting someplace, he'd simply ask a passerby. Carla was an excellent lead for the couple. Before their wedding, Mario had taught her to walk with Jane and him. Carla needed to learn how to leave enough clearance so that Jane, who walked on his right, would not bump into anything. Mario responded to signals from Carla, while Jane got her nonverbal cues from Mario by simply holding his elbow and following Mario's body up or down at curves or starting and stopping. Jane remembered many years later, after a too short honeymoon in Chicago, we took the train back to Muncie. That was the end. That was the beginning. It was the end of the romance and the beginning of our married life. Married life was not as rosy as Jane had pictured it. Although Mario was busy practicing law, he didn't have enough money to rent an apartment. Aletta and Antonio offered them a room in their small 3-bedroom home on Charles Street, which Mario gratefully accepted. Jane wasn't happy about being dependent upon her new in-laws and hoped this would be a temporary solution. She longed for their own apartment, where she could cook and clean without Aletta watching her every move. While adjusting to married life in her in-laws' home, tensions mounted in the United States as World War II raged in Europe. The U.S. had hoped to have avoided being drawn into the war. But when the Japanese suddenly attacked Pearl Harbor only 6 weeks after Mario and Jane's wedding, the United States was thrust into the conflict. As the U.S. geared up for war, many resources were directed toward the military, which created shortages for the public. People became fearful that food such as meat, sugar, and cheese would become scarce and began hoarding supplies. Food ration books were issued with complicated point systems. With Jane giving their allotments to Antonio and Aletta, there was usually enough food for the four of them. Although careful planning was necessary, having a sugar coupon didn't guarantee that sugar would be on the store shelves. Aletta and Jane shopped often in the hopes of finding meats or other staples. Jane enjoyed shopping with her mother-in-law. She got out of the house, and it helped to pass the time. Although she used her daughter-in-law's coupons to help purchase the food, Aletta wouldn't allow Jane to help in preparing it. "I've always done the cooking, and I don't want anyone else in the kitchen. I know how to cook what Mario likes," she said with authority. Aletta had no intention of allowing her to touch a pot or a skillet. The rejection brought memories of how her own mother banished her from the kitchen. She was deeply frustrated, and that she still couldn't practice the cooking skills learned at school. Instead of feeling like a competent wife, Jane spent the late afternoon sitting in a living room chair, listening to Aletta clanking pans and smelling the aromas of dinner cooking. Mario enjoyed sitting down in the living room with his parents after their evening meal, chatting about the day's events. Jane could either join them or retire to her bedroom. There was no other place for her to go in the house, except in good weather when she could sit out on the front porch swing. If she wanted a private conversation with her husband, she had to wait until bedtime when they were in their room. "Mario," Jane whispered, "your mother won't let me cook, and today she told me that she will do our laundry." "I can do the wash. She won't let me do anything around here." "Well, that's Mom. It's her house, and she has her own ways," replied Mario softly. "I'd do it her way. She fawns over you and ignores me. We're husband and wife, and I can't be a wife in her house. Mario sighed. It's only a few months until I can save enough money for our own apartment. I thought that Mom would keep you company while I'm at work. I don't know if I can last that long. She's not much company. I hear her working all day long while I'm doing nothing. It makes me feel bad that I'm not contributing. And today, she and your dad were talking in Italian, so I wouldn't know what they were saying. I don't know if they're talking about me or about going to the store. I'm sure they weren't talking badly about you. How do you know? You weren't there. Your mom doesn't like me. I'm so tired of being alone every day. Maybe you can visit with Virginia. She's busy with her children. I can't go to see her alone, and it's hard for her to talk on the phone with the little ones. I don't know anyone else. I can't go out unless Aletta takes me. I'm just stuck. Mario sat on the bed, pulling on his pajama bottoms and yawning. Well, I don't have an answer, but Mom and Dad have done so much for me, I really can't say anything to them. Can't you at least tell them to speak English when I'm around? Asked Jane. Mario sighed. I don't want to upset them. Well, then, can we at least have more time in the evenings by ourselves? Your parents are always around, listening in, or you're talking to them. I miss just talking with you. Jane, my parents have sacrificed so much for me. All my life they've worked hard on their feet, making and selling ice cream and candy, just so they could take me to all those doctors to cure me. And when they realized that I'd always be blind, they saved for my education. They didn't take much for themselves. I owe them some time in the evenings. Jane frowned and bit her lip. She wanted to say, "You owe me some time in the evenings, too." But she realized with a sinking heart that she'd never win that battle. His mother was always going to take precedence in their relationship. Her husband was emotionally unable to stand up to his mother. On some level, Mario felt guilty about causing his mother so much suffering about his blindness. Even as a young child, he knew that her efforts to find a cure were all in vain, yet he had to obey her and submit to many examinations and treatments. Aletta was a too powerful figure in Mario's life, and this unfortunate pattern for the marriage was set. Every day was frustrating and humiliating for Jane. She felt like a child again, although now it was her mother-in-law telling her what she couldn't do. Mario had imagined that Aletta and Jane would enjoy each other's company and didn't realize how much tension had flared up between them. Jane knew that Mario wouldn't confront his mother, so she didn't tell him how tired she was of watching Aletta fawn over him, treating him like a child while being snubbed herself. He couldn't see her face as she pursed her lips while Aletta indirectly or pointedly remarked on Jane's ability to function on her own. He didn't know how useless his wife felt day after day, or how criticized. The stress of living with her in-laws, combined with worry about the war accelerating and involving the United States, left Jane feeling helpless and lonely. Mario worked hard all day, then came home and wanted to spend evenings visiting in the living room with his parents. Jane was disappointed and frustrated that once again her parents-in-law took precedence over her. Mario was in demand as a speaker and was out several nights a week talking to church or civic groups. Mario enjoyed giving those speeches and rarely turned down an invitation to talk about his seeing eye dog or to advance the cause of blind people. But for Jane, each talk was yet another lonely evening spent listening to the radio. His speeches were often covered in the local papers, including one talk in 1944, where Mario described what blind people were doing for the war effort. He emphasized that handicapped persons were making their own contributions and hoped that they wouldn't be displaced after the war with returning soldiers. It was a constant battle to educate the public and the employers that blind people could work and be productive citizens, not just be dependent upon family, or worse yet, beggars. There was no federal safety net in 1944 for the disabled. Some states paid a small monthly pension, but it wasn't enough for one to live independently. One civic group that both Jane and Mario enjoyed was the Delaware County Workers for the Blind, an organization that provided assistance, social events, and help for over 300 blind and visually handicapped people in the county. Mario served as president of the organization in 1941. While they enjoyed the monthly meetings, Jane needed more socializing and outside activities. Yet with no telephone or transportation, she felt stuck. Jane sorely missed her mother and sisters. Each day she eagerly awaited the mail, hoping for Braille letters from her mother and sister, their sole means of communication. Her parents' telephone was used for local calls only. Long distance was too expensive and reserved for emergencies or to relay bad news. Visiting in person was nearly impossible because gasoline was rationed. Jane's family drove sparingly, and a trip to Muncie used too much gas. Antonio didn't drive or own a car, but even if he did, Jane wouldn't feel comfortable asking him to drive her to the farm. She could only dream about one day they would have their own home where she could cook and take care of the house without her mother-in-law's critical eye watching her every move. Chapter 23. Free at Last. After a year of marriage, an apartment became available in a house that Antonio owned. Mario and Jane moved into the second floor of an old house that had been divided into two apartments. Jane was thrilled to have her own place. For the first time in her life, there was no one watching her, looking over her shoulder to make sure she wouldn't hurt herself or that she was doing something the right way. Jane read Braille cookbooks and taught herself how to cook. She learned the basics in high school, but that had been 10 years earlier, and she hadn't been able to practice. Jane insisted on an electric stove. She'd never forgotten the frightening sound of gas and the prospect of having to light a match every time that she wanted to turn a burner on was too much. She also asked Antonio to make little notches in the dials so she could feel the nicks and know which corresponded to the low, medium, and high settings. She liked to use the oven. With the temperature dial marked every 25 degrees, she learned quickly to make roast and baked potatoes. With Aletta's snarky comment, "You can't see, so how can you wash clothes and know that they're clean?" Fresh in her memory, Jane set about learning to do the laundry. The chore became a pleasure as she proved to herself and her skeptical mother-in-law that she could care for Mario. Like most housewives in the 1940s, Jane used a wringer-style washer. It was in a small nook near the kitchen. She hooked up a hose to add hot water, added soap powder, and waited while the washing machine swished the clothes. The next step was running each piece of clothing through the wringer, putting it into the little rollers while turning the handle to squeeze out the water. She was careful not to catch her fingers between the rollers, taking her time and concentrating on the task. Jane wanted spotless clothes. Aletta could be relied upon to point out any stains or dingy whites. Jane took her heavy basket full of wet laundry out to the backyard, where she hung the clothes on a line strung between two trees. She didn't mind the clothesline in the summer, but putting on a coat and retrieving underwear and sheets frozen stiff as boards in the winter was unpleasant. On rainy days, Jane used a wooden rack set in the dining room to dry the laundry. Jane taught herself how to iron using a modern electric iron. Mario's shirts needed to be perfectly pressed, or Aletta would be sure to notice. She smoothed out the wrinkles with her fingers, then ran the iron with her right hand while holding the fabric with her left. She could feel the heat from the iron before it got to her fingers. Most of the time, she maintained her concentration and avoided a burn. Once they were settled in their new home, it didn't take long for the couple to think about starting a family. They'd always wanted children, but were worried that they could be born with glaucoma. Visits to two doctors in Muncie convinced them that since there was no history of blindness on either side of the family, there was little likelihood that any children would be born blind. Both parents likely had recessive traits. Jane was pregnant with their first child in November 1942 when she received a phone call with devastating news. Pop called to tell her that her mother, Bessie, had passed away. She had been ill but had been up and doing chores when she said that she was tired. She just went to rest in her chair, but she never got up. Jane grieved that her baby would never know their grandmother. Indeed, Jane hadn't even told her mother of her pregnancy since she was waiting to finish her third month before announcing anything. When their families heard of Jane's pregnancy, she could tell by their reaction that they wondered how in the world two blind people would be able to care for a baby. Their doubt made her furious, and she wanted to shout, "I'm blind, not stupid!" Jane also knew that the Muncie community would be watching. Mario was becoming well-known, and she felt she'd have to be the perfect mother to prove herself. They were going to be held to higher standards than sighted couples. Jane knew that she couldn't see if the child's face was dirty, so she resolved to wipe her face after every meal. She bought extra baby clothes, enabling her to change the baby frequently and be confident that her outfits were clean. She didn't want people to say, "Oh, she can't see. She doesn't know that the baby is dirty. She's not a good mother." Anne was born on June 8, 1943, a healthy baby with normal eyes. After a few days in the hospital, they came home to their little apartment and began life as parents. Like any new parent, they were attentive and quick to meet her needs. Jane hadn't been around many babies and certainly didn't have any experience changing diapers. She was terrified that she'd poke Anne. She would rather poke herself with the sharp pin. Jane used her left hand to hold the diaper away from the baby and with her right hand guided the pin through the cloth to secure it. She pricked herself many times but never poked the baby. Diaper changing didn't end with a clean diaper. Jane still had to pick up the wet, dirty cloth and put it in the diaper pail to be washed later. Disposable diapers were almost 20 years in the future, and she couldn't afford a diaper washing service. Jane cleaned them in the washer that required her to put each diaper through the wringer to squeeze out the water, then dried them on the clothesline outside in warm weather. In the winter, she let them dry on a wooden rack in the small dining room. Mario wasn't much help with the baby. He couldn't change her diapers or give her a bath, but he loved to hold her while Jane cooked dinner or did chores. Jane nursed for a couple of months and then switched to formula. In the 1940s, it was considered more modern to use formula and bottle feed your baby. While that opinion has changed in recent years, it was easier for Jane to have Mario feed Anne in the evening, which freed her to do something else. Mario enjoyed his time with Anne, cooing and making silly noises while she sucked at the bottle. Late one afternoon after work, Mario climbed the steps to the apartment. He stopped to listen at the top. He heard Jane in the kitchen. Anne was in her playpen, playing with a ball that rang a bell positioned inside. "Hello, Anne," he said as he walked to the playpen. He picked up the ball, shook it, and said, "Anne, come and get the toy." She got up and toddled over. He could hear her footsteps on the pad, so he leaned over and reached out with his left hand, and there she was. He went around to the corner of the playpen and repeated the game. Anne was laughing as she crossed on the diagonal, going from corner to corner. "Jane, Anne can walk," he called out. Jane stopped stirring the pot of peas and hurried into the living room. "But she's in her playpen. How do you know she can walk?" "Listen," Mario said as he shook the toy. "Anne, come and get the toy." Laughing with glee, Anne obeyed. "I heard her footsteps," Jane reached the playpen and pulled out her daughter. Smiling, she said, "Well, now, I'll really have to be careful. Pretty soon, she'll be able to run away from me." Aware that it was time to childproof the apartment, Jane put away everything breakable or poisonous and added a wooded baby gate to the top of the stairs. She was terrified that Anne would fall down the steep stairs. Jane could hear her toddling around the apartment and know exactly where she was. Occasionally, Anne got too quiet, and Jane would call out her name. She'd laugh or make a noise, and Jane would go to her, reaching down to see what her hands were holding. Two neighbor girls, who were about 10 years old, came frequently to visit and play with Anne. They flattered Jane, saying that Anne looked like a movie star with her brown curly hair. One day, the girls asked if they could take Anne out to play in the backyard. They seemed responsible, so Jane agreed and allowed them to take her outside. Even so, she listened from the open window to make sure that she was okay. The girls proved to be reliable, and Anne enjoyed playing with them outside. Once, on a cool fall Saturday afternoon, the girls brought Anne home but forgot to close the gate at the top of the stairs. Soon after they left, Jane heard the most sickening sound imaginable. Anne was tumbling down the stairs, thumping against the wood in what seemed to be an endless fall. Mario and Jane were horrified. They ran down the stairs and found her crying, but unhurt. Jane carefully checked her, feeling her head, arms, trunk, and legs. She couldn't find any sticky blood, and nothing seemed to be broken. Jane was too shaken to hold her, so Mario carried her back up the stairs. Moments later, she stopped crying and began playing with her toys. She got over the fall a lot faster than her parents. Chapter 24. Convention Adventures. Feeling more comfortable in his law practice, Mario developed an interest in local politics. When he began regularly attending Democratic Party meetings, one of the leaders noticed and decided that the bright young man would be an asset to the party. To encourage him, the mentor offered Mario a free one-day pass to the 1944 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. The offer included a first-class train ticket, which sealed the deal for Mario. Fascinated with trains from his earliest blurry memories of steam engines belching smoke, he'd taken many train rides but had never been able to afford first-class fare. On a humid July evening, Mario said goodbye to Jane and Anne, harnessed his dog Carla, and took a taxi to the Muncie train station. Passenger trains were common in the 1940s and were equipped with sleeper cars and elegant dining cars. The first-class section was at the rear of the train, lessening the likelihood that the engine's black smoke would enter the car through the open windows. He boarded the train to Indianapolis at 10:30 p.m. and made his way to the last car, hoping that it would be an observation car with an outdoor platform equipped with chairs and a place to stand. Most travelers preferred to stay inside, but Mario wanted to experience train travel riding outside, feeling the motion of the train and enjoying the sounds. He pushed on the last door, and to his delight, it opened. He found himself standing on the platform, the wind loudly rushing past his face. Too excited to sit down, he spent most of the hour and a half trip standing outside, leaning on the rail. He smiled as he listened to the turning of the wheels and the clanging of warning bells at the crossings. Mario remembered his many previous train trips when he rode inside a regular coach. Although those seats were comfortable enough, he couldn't hear any of the outside sounds, only people's voices or the crying of babies. He'd been frustrated that he couldn't hear the clacking of the wheels or the powerful whistle. The air was typically stale, with cigarette smoke and cheap perfume assailing his keen sense of smell and sometimes giving him headaches. The train slowed as they approached the train yards in Indianapolis, gently rocking back and forth. The observation car bounced occasionally over switches that led to side tracks, which were full of freight cars waiting to be coupled together to make a long train. Mario hung on to the railing, breathing deeply, and even enjoying the sulfurous smell of coal burning. The brakes screeched as the train came to a stop. No passengers were moving to get off, so he knew that they weren't at the station yet. A sudden, loud whistle announced the imminent arrival of another train. He felt the vibrations on the platform and knew it was going to be passing only feet away. When the engines roared past, Mario was thrilled to feel their immense power and size. The clanking, groaning, and squealing of the freight cars was thunderous. He was tempted to reach out and touch, but he knew that was a bad idea. Eventually, his train began to slowly move again. When they arrived at the station, a conductor directed Mario to the Chicago train waiting on a nearby platform. Now, after midnight, he and Carla followed another conductor down the narrow aisle to his bunk. Berths were on both sides of the aisle, stacked too high. Mario was glad to have the bottom bunk, but it was barely wide enough for him to turn over and too short for his long legs. There was no room for Carla to sleep on the floor. He never allowed her to sleep with him, but was forced to break the seeing eyes rules that night. Mario said, "Carla, jump up!" And she happily complied. He drew the thin curtain, which provided his only privacy, and tried to get comfortable sharing the small space with his 70-pound companion. He smiled as the train's swaying motion rocked him to sleep. The next morning, as the train was approaching Chicago and Mario needed to get dressed, he found his clothes at the foot of the bed and with some amount of effort managed to put on his suit in the small space. He pulled open the curtain and stuck his feet out to get his shoes, which were under the bed. Carla got up and put her head on his shoulder. A groggy male voice across the aisle said, "Oh my God, look at that elephant!" Mario laughed and said, "No, it's just my seeing eye dog." He couldn't see the man's puzzled expression as he nonchalantly rose from his berth and walked with Carla to the dining car for breakfast. When Mario arrived at the Democratic Convention in the Chicago Stadium, he felt his head almost explode with sensory overload. The auditorium was bigger than any Mario had ever been in, the noise reverberating in the cavernous space. A man shouted his speech into a microphone, which carried his voice. But from the babble of voices in the audience, Mario knew that there were few listening to him. Delegates were talking and walking around, often bumping into him as he tried to listen to what the man was saying. Carla's head moved from side to side, but she remained calm as she worked to lead her master through the throngs of people. That morning, in the dining car, Mario had met a man from Richmond, Indiana, who was also going to the convention. Mario and his new friend spent the first 2 hours together as Mario got his bearings in the vast building. Navigating alone through the noise and crowds would have been very difficult, and he was grateful for a guide. There was no doubt that Roosevelt would be renominated for his fourth term as president, so the delegates argued about the vice presidential candidate. Roosevelt and his followers wanted Henry Wallace, who was Roosevelt's second vice president, but Wallace was much too liberal for many of the delegates. That's when Mario first heard about an opposing candidate from Missouri named Harry Truman. Long debates dominated the day. When somebody opposed Wallace, the Wallace crowd booed and made ugly sounds, surprising Mario at how strongly people felt about their candidate. Experiencing the atmosphere in the room was much different than following the proceedings at home on the radio. It became unpleasant for Mario to listen to the rancor, and by late afternoon, he'd heard enough. It was time to take Carla out for a walk and get some fresh air. His return train didn't leave until 10 p.m., so he decided to walk over to the convention headquarters at the Stevens Hotel. He was familiar with the hotel because he and Jane had spent their honeymoon there 3 years prior. Mario and Carla wandered through the halls until he came to a ballroom with open doors. He stood and listened, hoping to hear the topic of the discussion. Sir, would you like to join us? Asked a delegate. We're the Texas Democratic delegation. Sure, I have a little time before my train leaves. May I take your arm? You can sit next to me, the delegate said. We're upset because we've been thrown out of the convention just because we're conservative. They say that something was wrong with our credentials, but that's not true. And we're mad, real mad. Mario listened to the controversy and was appalled at the speaker's use of language and anger. The man sitting next to him had seemed so pleasant, yet here he was yelling back at the speaker and even using worse foul language. Feeling uncomfortable with the exchanges, Mario checked the time by pushing the small button on the side of his watch. When the lid flipped open, he fingered the watch hands and the braille numbers. Much to his relief, it was time for him to leave for the train station. He enjoyed the cool night air and relative quiet after the raucous events of the day. He found the train station with no difficulty and boarded the train home. While a bit disappointed that the return ticket was only in coach, he was still able to take short naps sitting up. He arrived back in Muncie at 6 a.m., thoroughly exhausted, but with a new appreciation and an appetite for politics. Chapter 25. Changes. Antonio had closed the confectionery store in 1936 when Mario was finishing his pre-law studies at Ball State Teachers College. Tired of working long hours, he decided he would make more money buying and renting out foreclosed homes in Muncie. As the Depression economy improved, he bought three new lots on a newer neighborhood on West Jackson Street, only about three blocks from Charles's house. Antonio built two houses in the middle of the block, rented out the larger one, and moved into the smaller house next door. He moved one of his bungalow rental homes onto the third lot, which was on the corner of Jackson and Cole Streets. Antonio offered to rent Mario and Jane that house. They jumped at the chance to have more space and their first house. Mario was thrilled to be closer to Charles, and Jane was happy for Anne to have cousins to play with. The house was small, but more importantly, it had a fenced backyard where Anne could play safely without Jane worrying about her running into the street. In the spring of 1946, Mario and Jane prepared to move to their new home. Jane learned that she was pregnant again. She was excited about the upcoming life changes, but given her prior experience with Aletta, worried about living next door to her mother-in-law. Being so close provided some benefits, but also came with emotional strings attached. Aletta could watch from her windows or come over unexpectedly. Jane did not want to feel those critical eyes watching her every move. Jane was frustrated that Mario had been unable to tell his mother not to interfere or criticize her. She blamed his lack of assertiveness on being just a little too Italian, believing that Italian cultural stereotype where the mother is always right, and even grown men don't argue with their mothers. Further, she suspected that Mario relished being spoiled by his mother. Jane wasn't going to spoil him. She believed he needed to do things for himself and spend time with her and the children. Mario knew how much his mother worried about him and how many sacrifices she had made on his behalf. Aletta didn't have many outside interests. Her life revolved around her family. Other than walking two blocks to St. Mary's Catholic Church for the daily 7 a.m. Mass, she rarely left the house. She spoke some English, but wasn't comfortable in the language and didn't have many friends. Mario felt guilty that if he didn't visit every evening with his mother, and while he knew Jane's preferences, he still chose to please his mother. His choice helped to solidify a lifelong smoldering conflict between the two women. Moving into the new house took a lot of planning. Movers helped to pack everything, but they needed to be told where to put it once they arrived. Before the move, Jane and Mario went to the house and walked around, memorizing the layout. It was easy to decide where to place the furniture. The living room had a plain wall with no windows or doors. The couch went on that wall, and the coffee table went in front of the couch. They always had to remember that it was there, since the table's sharp edges bruised their shins if they misjudged or forgot about its location. Aletta helped Jane shop for new curtains. She described the colors and patterns of the fabric while Jane felt each fabric sample. Jane tried to visualize what the design looked like as Aletta took her hand and ran it over the pattern to show Jane how big it was. It must have been frustrating to rely on her mother-in-law's opinion, but Jane made the final decisions. Having their home look as normal as possible was very important to the couple. They put pictures of Anne and some landscapes on the walls. They turned on the lights when it began to get dark, and Mario turned them off when it was time for bed. Although he had a very small amount of light perception, he also lightly touched the bulb to check for heat, which indicated that the bulb was on. He didn't want to turn on a bulb that should be off. Anne, of course, needed the lights at night, and they wanted people to know that they were home. If it were dark inside, friends might assume that nobody was there. Although Jane did almost every chore in the home, she refused to feed coal to the basement furnace. Throwing coal into a hot fire was a dirty and dangerous task, which Mario undertook with enthusiasm. He couldn't fix things around the house like many other husbands, but he could keep the home fires burning. "Anne, would you like to come down into the basement with me and watch me put coal into the furnace?" asked her father. "We need to add more coal now, because if we don't, this house will get mighty cold." "Yes, I want to see the fire." 4-year-old Anne was not allowed in the basement without an adult, and she was excited to have the opportunity to go down with her dad. Anne and Mario felt the air become damp and cool as they descended the wooden steps. It was dark, with only a dim light bulb and a window at ground level to provide a sliver of light. The furnace seemed huge, with ducts that resembled octopus tentacles reaching up towards the ceiling. Mario opened the furnace door. Heat rushed out, and Anne took a step back. "Oh, it's really hot!" She watched as her father slowly pulled on a pair of heavy gloves and picked up a handful of coal from the bin. The hot flames danced inside while he tentatively felt for the opening and threw it in the coal. "Dad, aren't you scared?" "Well, I'm careful. I can feel how hot it is, and the gloves keep my hands from getting burned. I can hear the coal as it lands in the furnace, so I know that I threw it in the right place. I use gloves because I can't keep the coal from sliding off the shovel. It's easier for me to just pick it up. Here, I'll throw in some more coal. There, can you hear it?" Anne peered around her father and winced as the flames grew higher. "Yes, but it's scary. Can we go back upstairs now?" "Sure. It's important, though, that I don't let the fire go out. It would get awfully cold in the house, and I couldn't get it started back up again by myself. Your grandpa would have to come over, and it's a lot of work, so he wouldn't be happy. I'll be back tomorrow morning and put some more coal in." Anne ran to the stairs, happy to leave the furnace monster behind. Several years later, when the nuns at St. Mary's talked about the fires of hell, she got the picture. Anne was good at entertaining herself, but Jane felt that she needed more than what she could provide at home. When Emerson Country Day School offered Anne a scholarship, Jane and Mario immediately accepted. It was considered an excellent preschool, and although only 3 blocks from the house, they had no way to get her there. Mario worked in the opposite direction, and Jane never walked anywhere outside the house unescorted. Aletta did not volunteer to walk her granddaughter to school, so Jane and Mario decided that at age 3, Anne could walk to school by herself. They taught her how to cross the quiet side streets, and when she arrived at the busy Tillotson Street, the son of the school's owner met her and helped her to cross. In 1946, there was little traffic, and nobody worried about strangers kidnapping their children. Anne enjoyed walking to school, feeling safe as she waved to neighbors protectively watching from their porches. Jane stood at her front steps, listening for her cheerful, "Bye, Mom! I'm crossing the street now!" With a smile and a wave, Jane called after her, "Be careful crossing the next street. I'll see you at lunchtime." After walking past several houses, Anne came to the Cardinal shop. She always paused to look at their windows full of toys, books, school supplies, and dolls on display. Next was the Ray Kiesling's grocery store and restaurant. Ray knew the Peroni family well and kept a running tab so when the children grew older, they could go and pick up grocery items for their mother. Across the street from Kiesling's was a wooded lot that Anne especially enjoyed passing. Violets covered the ground every spring, and Anne liked to bring home little bouquets for her mom. It didn't matter what the weather was like. Even tromping in the snow was fun as she watched the tracks her boots made. Anne never complained about the walk. Nursery school was fun, and there was always something interesting to see on the way. Jane delivered their second child, John Charles, on December 31st, 1946. She found that caring for him was easier since she knew more of what to expect and was more experienced with diapers and bottles. Anne was 3 and a half and excited to have a baby brother. As he grew older, she entertained him with toys and let Jane know that if he was getting into something he shouldn't. Anne learned very quickly, though, to put away the toys and to never leave anything on the floor where her parents could trip over them. If Jane walked into the living room where she was playing on the floor, she warned her mother and Jane walked around her. Mario and Jane relaxed by reading the Braille editions of the Reader's Digest magazine. Jane also enjoyed Ladies' Home Journal and Good Housekeeping. Mario read more scholarly journals, including America, which discussed events and controversies in the Roman Catholic Church. Although they couldn't read print books or magazines, it was important that they set a good example for their children. Most of the time, Jane had no regrets about being a blind mother. But while tucking her children into bed at night, she often wished that she could cuddle next to them and read them a story. Braille children's books didn't exist then, and even if they had, the experience would have been very different. Since there are no pictures in a Braille book, a sighted young child would be bored staring at Braille dots. Half the fun of reading a picture book is talking about the illustrations, something that is lost if the parent can only finger the words. Between nursery school and Mario often asking her to spell the words on signs or on cereal boxes, Anne learned the alphabet and simple words. It wasn't surprising to Mario and Jane that Anne learned to read at a very early age. She brought home books from school and read the new children's magazine highlights from cover to cover as soon as it arrived. Later, when Anne was in elementary school, they subscribed to the print edition of Reader's Digest, Saturday Evening Post, and Life magazines. Mario often asked Anne to describe what she saw around her. He did it partly to orient himself, but mostly it was his way to increase her vocabulary. On evening walks with Anne, he'd asked her to read letters from signs and tent, then he would tell her the word. She might tell him about the White House with the big tree in front, and if the tree were close to the sidewalk, they'd stop and put their arms around it to see how big it was. "My, that's a big tree. It must be very old. I can't even reach all the way around it, can you?" Mario reached down to feel Anne's arms as she stretched to hug the tree. "Oh, I see that the tree is too big for you, too. You'll have to grow very long arms to hold this tree." Anne laughed and stopped at many big trees on their walks. One summer night, when Jane and Mario were sitting out on the front porch swing, Mario asked Anne, "What do you see in the sky tonight?" "There's a moon," she answered. "How does it look?" "Tonight," she said, "it's all put together." We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.